This season of Power Corrupts is ad-free. I'm not going to tell you about overpriced socks or some random mortgage website. But if you want to support the show by helping to offset the costs of making Power Corrupts, there are two ways you can pitch in. First, pre-order my new book, Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, which comes out on November 9th. If you like this podcast, I promise you'll love this book. Second, become a Patreon subscriber for just $3, euros, or pounds per month, and get access to exclusive bonus content and more. Go to patreon.com/powercorrupts. Thanks for listening and for your support.
The day of the murder, I was the on-call detective. We usually have at least one detective who's on-call. We take turns every week. This was a Sunday, the weekend, and I happened to be the guy that Sunday. So I was at home with my wife and received a phone call from Sergeant Gwen Martin. She was a patrol sergeant at the time. And she started telling me that they were on the scene of a apparent suicide. I could tell she was emotional. It appeared to be an adult female who was dead from an obvious gunshot wound to the head. But he said at that time, this is the case where the female was receiving threats on the internet. So that sort of jogged my memory at that time. And I asked, well, why do you want me there? Because if it's a obvious suicide, they don't necessarily need a detective there. But he said, well, we're just kind of concerned because of these previous threats on the internet. And a couple things are sort of weird about this case. You know, would you mind coming in and taking a look at it, basically? So I headed in. It took me probably an hour or so to go from my house to the police department to pick up my unmarked police vehicle and then get to the scene. It looked like a suicide to me at first. There were a few things that stood out to me as kind of weird, not necessarily inconsistent with the suicide. What was odd was the fact that she seemed to be going about her normal duties. She was roasting pumpkins on a big roaster in her kitchen. And so the smell of roasting pumpkin was permeating the inside of the house. She was right-handed. I asked the detectives to ask her husband what hand she was, and she was right-handed. But the gun was found basically in the crook of her left arm, right at her elbow area. If she shot herself and went down, it's possible the gun could have bounced or something and ended up in that place. But it's a little more difficult for the gun to end up in her left arm area than the right if she was right-handed. So that was weird. Once I got on scene, they filled me in a little bit more on the background of this case, and I started to sort of remember a few more details.
That's Randy McAllister, the Deputy Director of Public Safety and a police captain.
So right below the Chief of Police.
In the Cottage Grove Police Department in Minnesota, the state where I grew up, Randy was describing a horrible day in which he attended to a crime scene after the lifeless body of Amy Allwine had been discovered. At first glance, it appeared to be a suicide, but appearances in this case were universally deceiving. It turned out something much more sinister was going on, with tentacles that reached all across the globe and into the darkest realms of the internet. Why was Amy Allwine murdered? Who killed her? And what does her death teach us about the ways that the economics of the dark web can keep people safe or cause them to die? This is a story, a stranger-than-fiction tale, of what happens when you gain access to a long list of people who are being targeted for murder before someone has tried to kill them.
And what do you do when you have a way to spot criminals in the making, if you wish, or wannabe killers?
I'm Brian Kloss, and you're listening to Power Corrupts, the podcast where we shine a light onto the hidden and often nefarious forces that shape our world.
Thank you.
So the first thing is, I always ask people is, could you please introduce yourself at however you want to be known to my audience so I can use your voice instead of mine?
Sure. So my name is Eileen Ormsby. I'm an investigative journalist and author from Australia, and my specialty is the dark web.
For somebody who is listening, who has never heard of the dark web, has no idea what Tor is, et cetera, how do you describe it when you meet people who are not so tech savvy?
Well, the dark web is the colloquial name that we give to websites that can't be searched for or accessed on the regular web, or what I call the clear web. So even if you've got the exact URL address and you pop that into your browser, you won't be able to find it. They require a special software to get to them. And the most popular software for that is called Tor. Tor is completely legal, it's free, it's a very small download, and it just opens up a browser that looks exactly like your other browser. But the difference is this one can access those dark web sites.
Most of the stories about the dark web are about drug markets, hitmen, or abusive children. The stuff that really puts the dark in dark web.
The massive difference the dark web has made is it has created a space where they can actually advertise for customers. They can operate really, really openly and brazenly and set up these shops that look like any other e-commerce shops and attract customers to them.
But the dark web is also used for good purposes, simply when someone needs an extra level of untraceable privacy.
A lot of newspapers now actually have secure drops on the dark web so that any whistleblowers that want to provide documents can upload those documents to the secure drop, safe in the knowledge that there is no way of tracing that back to them, no digital footprint back to them whatsoever. Even the CIA has a dark web presence. If you go to the CIA on the dark web, it's exactly the same as their clear website pretty much, but it also offers whistleblowers or people that want to report terrorist activities an opportunity to do that with complete anonymity. So that's the whole thing behind that, the dark web, is the anonymity that it provides. And that can be provided for good or it could be provided for bad, just like anything else.
We're going to put aside the legitimate side of the dark web for the moment, though. And we're going to zoom in on a particular niche that can only be accessed with this special browser called Tor. It's a website called Besa Mafia.
There is a website where people try to hire hitmen to kill people, to kill other people, and pay in Bitcoin.
That's John Vopicelli, a senior editor at Wired.
At least two people linked to the website have been found dead in violent circumstances. In one case, we know why, and we know that the person put the hit on his wife actually killed her. In another case, we don't really know what happened, but the whole situation is absolutely suspicious.
But before we get to Besa Mafia, we need to take a step back first. Imagine that I decide I want to get a hitman. What do I do? Do I just type into a search bar murder on the dark web?
Well, it's pretty hard to get a hitman on the dark web. Hitman services have always been a staple of the dark web. So ever since I've been in there, there's always been at least a few people purporting to offer hitman services on there. Originally, they actually offered them through the darknet markets. So they're the great big markets that sell your drugs and your weapons and your digital goods, all those sorts of things. So they originally tried to put their services on there, but nearly all the dark net markets said, no, we're not interested in your services. It's okay if people want to buy drugs, but we're not interested in having hitmen put their services on our site. So they went and got their own sites.
And here's where we get a brief economics lesson. The dark web thrives on anonymity. If you're good at navigating the dark web markets, you don't know who you're buying from and they don't know who you are.
So once you've gone into the Tor browser, anything that you search for, any site that you visit, there is going to be no artifacts whatsoever about that on your computer. You can have the best computer expert that ever existed coming in, and they will not be able to find those searches. They will not be able to find what sites that you've been to.
That makes it safer for those consumers who are purchasing illegal items or services, because it's less likely that you'll get caught. After all, the seller can't snitch on you if they don't know who you are. But that anonymity disrupts something that we usually count on in modern economics, the notion that the seller has a built-in incentive to keep their customers happy. As Eileen explains, that's not always true on the dark web, particularly for one-off purchases, like hiring a hitman.
The only things that are really viable to to be sold over the dark web are things that require repeat custom and are easily transferable. So Hitman Services doesn't actually fulfill either of those things. Very few people think after the first hit, oh, that was good, I'll go and get another one and I'll tell my friends. And it's not an easily transferable product because it's a service, it's a personal service. So, you know, once you've paid money, paid Bitcoin to the online hitman, he has absolutely no incentive whatsoever to carry out the hit. Why would he? He's doing it for the money and you've given him the money. Even if you only give him half up front, he's still got free money. So there's no incentive for them to do it whatsoever.
Nonetheless, there are websites where you can supposedly hire a hitman. But all of them, at least to Eileen's trained eye, looked amateurish, and they were obviously not the real deal.
I tried to contact several of them to put out a fictitious hit on a fictitious ex-husband, or a real one, but one that's already dead. It was very obvious that they were very much like your 419 scammers, or what traditionally called Nigerian scammers, as in they ask for money up front, they always have excuses for why they can't do anything, and none of that came across as being real at all. You know, you ask these people, and often they're just one guy, oh, can you do it in Australia? Yes, no problem, you know, and they were obviously not real.
Then suddenly, there was a new entry into the arena of hitman for hire websites. It was called Besa Mafia. Besa is the Albanian word for honor, and this one stood out. It was different, though its early design did raise some eyebrows.
I remember the first website was essentially like a, I think it was a kind of gay porn model with a gun. it was a bit strange.
Soon, it became clear that this new player was serious about his websites, and he wanted to make them look as professional as the hitmen that he supposedly represented.
So it wasn't until, I think, 2016 that a much more slick and professional-looking site came up. So if you were to put in the search term is hire a hitman onto your Google search, I think his is one of the first sites that comes up, which is hireahitman.pw, and it actually ranks and lists all the hitman services that are on the dark web. And the fact is that ranks and lists. The only ones that he says are real are his hitman services. And like any good businessman, he's got an economy one and a premium one. So you can either get the gangbangers for $5,000 to $10,000, or you can go for the premium snipers, international stuff for $20,000 plus. And then when you find those sites, if you put them into the Tor browser, because they won't open up in your regular browser, you put them into your Tor browser and you will come to those sites where you can sign up, sign in, read the testimonials and place an order with the site.
Let's speak about the sort of weird aspects of the premium versus the economy package and whether there's like a TripAdvisor style review page. I mean, that's a tantalizing detail. Is it the testimonials say things like, you know, killed on time or what kinds of things do the reviewers say?
Very much so. The amazing thing about these testimonials is all the people that have been killed deserved it. So there was someone that raped your sister or someone that was being a standover man for local businesses, all that sort of thing. So they're nearly all very bad people that got killed, and the people that took out the hits are very happy with the service that got provided. It happened swiftly and nobody ever knew that it happened, all those sorts of things, made it look like an accident. So all the things that you'd expect.
Besa Mafia provided innovation in the hitman for hire business model. Rather than supposed hitmen advertising their services directly, Yura, the name or pseudonym behind the Besa Mafia website, promised to be the middleman, the guy who hooked you up with the right hitman for the job.
He offered to connect people that wanted hits with hitmen. And he said that, you know, they'd mostly be gang members, they came from all over the world, and if you placed an order, he'd connect you with one that was nearby. And he was very convincing. And he put out a strong marketing plan that he put out all over the web, over the ClearNet, onto Reddit and places like that, with people that had been there and found it genuine. And he drummed up a lot of interest in his site. So I was one of the people that was interested. Another person that was interested was a security researcher in the UK by the name of Chris Montero.
I wrote to Chris, who runs a website and a blog called Pirate London. And for various reasons, he said that he couldn't speak to me. But both John and Eileen have worked with him really closely for years.
What is Chris like? What does he look like? What sort of makes him tick?
He's a tall guy. I think he's of Irish and Indian descent. he is the classic person who attends these kind of hyper-futuristic meetups. Montero has always been very focused on debunking stuff from fake news, conspiracy theories, healthcare myths. I don't want to call him a nerd. He has some nerdy elements about him, possibly. But he's also a very serious person, very methodical. Probably the best description I can give of him as a kind of mindset is as a Wikipedian. He really tries to systematize what he sees and to guess the rest, the footnotes, to footnote everything he says. And that's why, even if the story was totally crazy, I never doubted for a second that it made a lot of sense, because for each thing, there was essentially a footnote. I could check and double check and fact check. I checked with other sources, of course, but every time that Chris would give me something, he would always add a lot of backup material that was very easy to verify. I found other sources. There were many other people involved in the situation, but a Wikipedian is probably the best way to describe the mindset.
Chris and Eileen both started independently researching the Besa Mafia website, trying to get to the bottom of this slick newcomer who claimed to provide you with a hitman for a reasonable fee, all paid anonymously in Bitcoin. But as they researched, their suspicions that the whole thing was a giant, audacious scam kept growing.
Both Chris and I, we wrote pieces all the time about how Besa Mafia was just as fake as the rest. It might have looked a little bit better, but it was just as fake as the rest.
But even as Eileen and Chris wrote about how Euro's website was just like all the others, a scam that promised hitmen, but just robbed you of your hard-earned Bitcoin, their certainty that Euro was a run-of-the-mill scammer got shaken quite badly.
And then one day, all of a sudden, Chris messaged me and said, you know, I'm freaking out. Look what's come in the mail. And in his email was a very badly done video, but it was a genuine video of a guy setting fire to a car and holding up a sign saying this is dedicated to you. And so he freaked out a little bit.
The video starts with someone holding up a piece of paper. Written on it are the words, quote, "Gang members for Besa Mafia, dedication to Pirate London, 10 April, 2016. Then the camera pans to a white car being engulfed by flames. Chris, understandably, was worried by this video in his inbox. In his experience, scammers just didn't behave like this. Perhaps he'd called out the wrong person. He started to wonder if he had accidentally made some very dangerous enemies. He decided to report the video to the police, but it was impossible to tell where the car had been burned, so it wasn't clear which jurisdiction was responsible for investigating. After a few attempts at getting law enforcement's attention, he decided to investigate the website himself. And thankfully for Chris, while Besa Mafia had spent a lot of time cultivating seemingly real testimonials, they hadn't spent much time securing the website itself.
You can do all these things and have the technologies of Tor and encryption and all that, but when your username is admin and your password is someone is going to be able to hack you pretty easily. And that's pretty much what happened.
Chris also figured out that the website didn't take basic precautions that were necessary to hide website content that was supposed to be private, including Euro's correspondence with potential customers. Chris figured this out in an unusual way. He made a fake account called Bodie McBoatface and tried to order a hit on Bob the Builder. But in clicking through the required steps on the site, he saw how sloppy the site's security was, and that allowed him to open up access to just about everything.
So we were into the back door of his website. He had no idea.
With limited effort, they were able to download the messages back and forth between Euro and those who desired his services. And the messages were dark, sure. But some of them were also extremely funny in the most macabre ways.
But I suppose that's something you get with every single scam. I mean, if you've seen those videos of people answering Nigerian princes' emails, they eventually just descend into absurdity.
Scammers are masterful at milking you for ever-increasing amounts of money. There's always a reason to send just a little bit more, and then you'll get what you're after, whether it's unlocking funds from a Nigerian prince, or, in this case, getting the hitman to carry out the murder. And Euro had a knack for coming up with some pretty amazing reasons why more money was always required, as supposedly professional hitmen kept running into unexpected troubles on the job.
Once he started, he got someone on the hook. It was that 419 scam all over again. He just kept on going in a way that would make a Nigerian prince proud. He would keep on saying, oh, look, you know, the hitman was on his way, but then he got pulled over by the police, have to send another hitman. That's going to cost another $1,000, and keep on drawing more and more money out of them until he realized that they had no money left.
Very stupid things, really. Not really very convincing. Something like, the hitman, who was traveling to the hit place, was stopped by a cop for, I don't know, traffic violation, for running through a red light or whatever. And they found a gun. And so he had to call the whole thing off. He was there. He was about to shoot your target. Then he saw a police car and he got scared and ran. Fled the scene. and so, of course, you have to kind of be very invested into seeing this through in order to believe those excuses. And also, it really speaks volumes. The kind of hitman personas that are depicted by these messages are kind of keystone hitmen, right? Some kind of zany, goofy, useless killers, which is why, of course, the usual next step is I can actually hire someone much more professional for the hit. This person, this professional hitman, which won't flee the scene if they see the cops, it will be more expensive. So you had to pay, I don't know, double the amount of Bitcoin you paid for the useless killer. And so, yeah, that really, in some cases, it worked. It usually doesn't work for long. I've seen people, of course, paying a lot for a long time and just being dragged along. But other people, after one or two excuses, they just stop paying, of course. And that's sort of normal.
We always figured it was a scam, but it's quite interesting to have it completely validated to us.
Now that Chris and John and Eileen knew that Euro was a scammer, albeit a more marketing-savvy scammer than the others, they decided to try to chat with him directly to get an insight into his business model.
Yeah, well, after we got the hack, I started corresponding with Euro quite a lot. At first, we were corresponding directly through his hitman site, and then we moved to email, and then we moved to instant chat. So it got to a point where he was basically pinging me every day to give me updates about things and how the world was going.
The way I did it was creating actually an account on the website, of course, under a false name and without creating any target. I put a hit on a shirt. It couldn't be interpreted by anyone as me putting a hit on anyone. And I wrote in the notes, I'm actually a journalist. I'd like to talk to you for this story. I tried to actually, in a way, also because I believed it, I tried to play the part of the person interested in the psychology behind why he would set up such a scam, which has so many interesting moral ramifications, right? So I said, well, I'm actually just interested a lot in the psychology of this. And also, I'm a libertarian, so, which I'm not really. I'm a sort of libertarian. So these kind of hyper unregulated association markets have been theorized for many years by libertarian thinkers. And so I think what you're doing is academically very interesting. So I tried to sort of to pull some strings.
Euro, it turned out, was a very pragmatic scammer. He understood full well that being exposed for what he was would destroy his business. And that was a problem because he was making a heck of a lot of money running this fake hitman website. So he figured, if you can't beat him, try to get him to join you.
At first, he was very angry at me. He threatened to send his hitmen after me, not realizing just how much information that I had and the knowledge that he didn't want to hurt anybody. And he also had no hitmen, telling me he was going to send them around to beat me up, to rape me, to find my family, all those sorts of things. But I did take that with a grain of salt because I knew that he didn't want to hurt anybody. So eventually it turned around where he started saying, oh, look, I'll cut you in. If you retract your articles, say that it is a real service, I'll cut you in. He said, look, my business has taken a massive hit, and he made a lot of money. In that short time, he made a lot of money. We're talking six figures in a couple of months. I believe he's from some sort of Eastern European country. He could live like a king on it. So he did not want his cash cow to die, of course. And then I said, look, as a journalist, I can't possibly do that. He said, well, what if you come to work for me? You know, I've actually got too much work and I can't keep up with all the emails. He was on the emails pretty much all day, every day. It was a full-time job for him, you know, sort of the ultimate work from home job. he said, "Oh, you know, I'll cut you in. I'll let you do that." And I was sort of a bit tempted, but, you know, the journalist in me thought, well, that could make a hell of a story, but I declined that one as well. I didn't think that was quite right.
And then he just started saying, well, I don't want to talk to you because I don't want you to write about this being a scam. It is a scam, but if you say it's a scam, bad people will stop using this. And so my mission as a scammer of killers will fail, right? Because my mission is making bad people, prospective killers, waste time and money and energy on this website as opposed to actually plotting the killing of the designated victims.
His idea, his whole philosophy was, if I wasn't doing this, if I wasn't scamming these people, they want to murder someone. And if I wasn't scamming them out of their money, they might go and find a real hitman, or they'll look for other ways to kill this person. But while they've paid me all this money and they think that I'm going to carry out the hit, then that person is safe.
This idea that Euro was somehow keeping people safe, at least for a time, is where Eileen and John disagree a bit.
I'm not sure that holds water.
You know, he had a point. He did really did have a point.
He also tried to suggest that he was working with FBI or something like that. I am not convinced. He was a classic scammer. He would always add ad hoc reasons for why he was doing something. Then he would change version.
And this is where the story diverges from Yura.
At some point, I realized that the story was much more complicated than it at the start, right? It wasn't really a story about a scam being uncovered and exposed.
After seeing Yura's scam emails, it became clear that in those correspondence, Yura wasn't the dangerous party.
In those emails to and from the people that he was scamming, there were sometimes hints that he wanted to make sure that nobody got hurt. And he was the guys that burnt the cars for him. So that was genuine. He really did hire people to burn the cars for him and put the signs on them. He absolutely make sure there's nobody around, make sure there's no people in them, make sure no people get hurt. So I had a feeling that he definitely wasn't going to send anyone around to beat me up, rape me, and kill my family.
So the people who were about among the users of this website, the people who paid to put a hit on someone, they were actually the real problem there. I mean, the admin was a very unsavory figure, of course, but the people who were users of this marketplace and paid bitcoins and sent pictures of their targets and hoped that actually a hitman, some kind of hitman, would kill their target. They were the dangerous ones because clearly they were very determined to get someone killed. So yeah, at some point I just realized it was about the kill list itself.
But now we had this situation where we had all these details. We had photographs, addresses, phone numbers, movements of all these people who had had hits placed on them. They weren't in any danger from a hitman, but you've got to imagine that they were going to be in some sort of danger from the person that paid $5, $10, $15, $20, up to $40,000 in Bitcoin to have these people killed. So we have this list, this kill list. Of course, what we want to do is alert law enforcement. Well, what I want to do is write a story, but I agree that we'll alert law enforcement first before I write the story because, you know, it was a pretty serious thing. Well, do you think we could do that? I tried the Australian Federal Police about all the Australian ones. Chris tried the NCA in the UK for all those ones. He was also in charge of doing all the FBI ones and talking to the FBI about the ones in the US. No one would listen to us. No one would ring us back. The Australian Federal Police said to me, oh, look, you know, why don't you try Scam Watch? Because, you know, maybe I'd use the wrong words and said it's a scam, but there's real people in trouble here. And so we found it very, very difficult to get anyone to listen to us.
Okay, forget about the hitman. There is no hitman. But what would you do if you were able to see the names of the victims and you know that someone wants to kill them? That's essentially the story, right? Well, now imagine someone actually did that. A person hacked this website and got access to all the victims, to all the victims' names. And he tried to warn them to stop this from happening.
And there was a worry that rather than keeping people safe, as Yura claimed, he was scamming some very dangerous people who might be triggered to act when they realized that the whole thing was a scam and that they had just lost a bunch of money. This is where dark web economics and criminal psychology intersect. Randy McAllister of the Cottage Grove PD again.
Yeah, you may try to string somebody along as long as you can. But on the other hand, I think the loss of those financial resources could essentially be a violence enhancer or a trigger, because he's getting more desperate and realizes he's losing all this money. And is somebody going to be able to trace that back to me? Those kinds of things can sort of tend to push him towards violence, I think, too.
The more you pay and the longer you keep paying, the more invested you are. These are kind of sunken costs there, and so you're more dangerous.
Finally, Eileen and Chris did get the attention of law enforcement, and they started notifying people who were on Besa Mafia's kill list. And that's when the FBI got in touch with Randy's colleagues in Cottage Grove, Minnesota.
They had come to us in May of 2016 and said, we came into possession of what they believed was sort of a hacked website. They came into possession of the data for this website in April or May of 2016. There were some email conversations and exchanges in that hacked material that identified Amy Allwine as a potential target for a murder for hire scam on the dark web.
Someone calling themselves Dog Day God had paid $13,000 to have Amy Allwine murdered.
This user, Dog Day God, stood out on the site as someone who was really serious about hiring a hitman, serious about killing their target. But this was not some gangland rival. Amy was a completely normal person, living a seemingly wonderful life with her husband, Stephen.
Amy and Stephen were, by all accounts, the perfect couple. They were very big church attenders and members. Stephen was in church leadership in their local congregation. In fact, he did a lot of preaching regionally for affiliates of their church. Stephen worked as an IT professional doing network support kind of things. He worked from home for two different, I think, insurance companies. So, folks would call in if they're having problems with the network, and he would figure out what was going on from home and fix it. So that's what he did.
Amy was a wife, a mother. She was a minister of religion.
Amy was a dog trainer, loved dogs. She had a business on their property. They had a large training facility there. So she just ran classes, three times a week, at least probably. And she would travel around the country to do dog shows and those kinds of things.
The correspondence between Dog Day God and Yura was chilling, with Dog Day God blaming Amy for ruining his life.
In those email exchanges, Dog Day God is sharing very personal information regarding these day-to-day activities of Amy, where she could be found, her travels, those kinds of things.
Dog Day God said that Amy had ruined their life by sleeping with their husband, and who then later left them. And that's why Dog Day God wanted Amy killed. So there was a massive list of emails back and forth after Dog Day God paid the money. And again, it was this whole thing of stringing them along.
Besa Mafia keeps promising, okay, today's the day or tomorrow we're going to do it. And then tomorrow comes and goes, and she's still alive. And Dog Day God's getting increasingly frustrated. That goes on for, I want to say it was about 2 months. And then finally, I think that's when the hack of Besa Mafia occurs.
Eventually, Yura just said, look, the site's been hacked. This is a scam. Bad luck. You've lost your money.
It doesn't take Hercule Poirot and Captain Hastings to recognize that this was a potentially deadly situation. A man who is serious about having someone murdered has just figured out that he's lost $13,000 in a murder-for-hire scam, and that no hitman is coming to do the job for him.
The FBI did go and visit Amy. They told her, this is what's happened. Do you know anybody that might want you killed? Dog Day God has said that you slept with their husband and their husband left them as a result. And she said, no, I've never slept with, I'm a woman of God. I'm faithful to my husband. Husband is also a minister. Never slept with anybody else. Have no idea who could possibly taken out this hit on me. And of course it worried her, but she didn't know. So they basically left it and said, oh, look, put in some extra security on the house, keep an eye out, give us a call if anything else happens.
They had got consent searches for a lot of her friends' phones and computers, credit reports, normal background stuff you would run.
Well, a few months after that, she started getting emails. Emails saying, you know, kill yourself. If you don't kill yourself, I'm going to kill your husband, kill your kid. You've got to kill yourself. And of course, that really upset her, and she told the FBI about that. But those emails had been sent from the dark web, so there was no way of tracing those.
Email services, things overseas, and I can't serve a subpoena or search warrant on a foreign company, computer company or email company. So anything that happened overseas, we're kind of stymied in terms of being able to get information.
This is one of those worrying glitches in the new era of policing, policing in the digital age. So much illicit activity is happening online, with uncertain jurisdictions, with untraceable methods, without seamless enough coordination between agencies and departments. For the people at the Cottage Grove Police Department, there wasn't much they could do. All they could really do is to warn Amy of what the FBI had found. And Amy, understandably, tried to take at least a bit of action to prepare herself for the threat.
Our police department has a citizens academy, like a lot of police departments. So we offer the opportunity to folks who live in Cottage Grove to come and sort of learn a lot more about the police department, how it works. And they do that over the course of 6 to 8 weeks. They'll do it, you know, one night a week, maybe for 2 or 3 hours. And one night they'll, you know, we'll do a canine demo. You know, another night we'll talk about criminal investigations, DWI enforcement, so everything. So, and Amy had gone through that academy and graduated 2 or 3 weeks before the murder. We kind of assumed it was probably because of the threats, but I never heard definitively.
Unfortunately, that wasn't enough to protect her. Amy was found dead in suspicious circumstances on November 13th, 2016.
Sort of the location where the house is, it's a rural area of Cottage Grove, if you will. It's very dark, lots of trees, huge lots. Everybody's got at least, you know, probably a 2-acre lot or bigger. So when I got there, there were lots of police cars on the road. It was dark. When I got out of my truck, I did walk past Stephen Allwine, who was talking with one of our police officers. My sort of observations of Stephen were that he was very composed. He didn't seem emotional. That was the same impression others had. You sort of file that away, but you take it worth a grain of salt because everybody responds differently to stress or to death, those kinds of things. So I wasn't sure what his baseline was, but it was a little out of the ordinary. So that was my first impression.
There are very few murders in Cottage Grove, Minnesota. In fact, since Randy joined the force back in the late 1990s, there had been just one other murder case. But he knew from his law enforcement experience and his training that when a woman is a victim of a violent crime, there's an obvious first place to look.
I try to really keep an open mind, finding out about the prior threats. I didn't want to focus on any one person, and I wanted, you know, in my mind, there's potentially still some unknown person or unidentified person out there who wanted Amy Allwine dead. So I kept an open mind. However, you know, my expertise over the years has really developed around domestic violence and stalking cases. So I knew that, you know, half of women murdered are murdered by a current or former intimate partner. So obviously the husband's always in the mix until they're ruled out.
And then Randy's suspicions that the supposed suicide seemed a bit weird, that something didn't feel quite right about the case, those suspicions were confirmed.
Sunday was the murder. Monday, we heard back from the medical examiner's office after the autopsy. They couldn't figure out the manner of death, the manner of being suicide, homicide, or natural.
That automatically triggered further forensic investigation. And in the process, it quickly became clear that something else had happened.
They called me about 3 a.m. on Tuesday morning and said, we're about done with the crime scene, with our part of it, so we need your detectives to come back and finish executing the rest of the search warrant. And they said, oh, by the way, you're going to be really interested in the luminol photographs because we were able to find that there were bloody footprints throughout the house. One thing we know is that people who commit suicide don't leave bloody footprints throughout the house after they're dead. So, I mean, that really was a huge piece of evidence. So at this point, we now knew that at a minimum, somebody cleaned up the crime scene. So was it somebody who came home and found her and was sort of ashamed by suicide, maybe embarrassed, because there's a lot of folks have that reaction? Or was it, in fact, the murderer who cleaned up after themselves? So that was a whole new wrinkle.
Stephen Allwine, Amy's husband, was brought in for questioning.
He made several statements that were inconsistent with what we found with some phone forensics. And he said he had never been on the dark web. He really had no knowledge of it. My phone forensic guy found a phone number on his cell phone for a female with just the first name. So there's no first or last name. And she was local. And we were able to quickly find evidence that he was having an affair with her. And then we found artifacts of Tor browser on his cell phone forensics, which obviously the only reason he used Tor is to get on the dark web. And that directly contradicted his statements that he knew anything about the dark web. We found Bitcoin artifacts or evidence that he was trading in Bitcoins, buying and selling Bitcoins, also on his cell phone forensics too. So another clue that says he's not being exactly honest with us.
They found evidence that Stephen had also ordered scopolamine, a drug that was found in Amy's system during the autopsy. The Cottage Grove Police Department began to build a rock-solid case that Stephen had drugged Amy, that he tried to get her to overdose on scopolamine, and then, after growing impatient that she didn't die, he shot her in the head.
He was Dog Day God. He had ordered scopolamine off the Dream Marketplace on the dark web and had it delivered. He had shot her, tried to stage it to look like a suicide. And the reason he did this was because, being a minister in his particular church, he was not allowed to divorce. He wanted out of the marriage. He was not allowed to divorce. So he chose to kill Amy rather than divorce her.
Stephen was convicted and sentenced to life in prison in early 2018.
New at 10 this evening, a jury has found a Cottage Grove man guilty of killing his wife after trying several times to pay someone to kill her. It took investigators several months to find evidence linking Stephen Allwine to Amy Allwine's death. After searching his many computers and phones, investigators say Allwine tried for months to hire a hitman on the dark web. That hidden network of websites requires special access. Tonight, a jury...
What does this case tell us about the dark web, about criminal psychology, about the ways we are still ill-equipped to deal with a world that digitized so fast that law enforcement often can't keep up? The case also raises thorny philosophical and ethical questions about a world in which we can use digital traces to predict crime before it happens, based on a user's search history or their visits to sites like Besa Mafia. For example, what should law enforcement do when they know that someone has visited a murder-for-hire site but hasn't paid any money? Should they ignore it? What about if someone has paid money for a hitman that they believe exists, but in reality, the hitman is just a dark web fantasy, peddled by a grifting Eastern European? And should those sites be allowed to operate if, as Yura claims, they're actually an outlet to keep people safe, who would otherwise be murdered? For the most part, the dark web hasn't created new crimes. Instead, it's created new dimensions to old crimes. In the past, people like Stephen Allwine might have had thoughts about murdering their spouses. Now, those thoughts leave digital traces. It's never been a crime to think of doing something. But that principle will be tested in the courts in the digital age as to what actually shows intent. And how can law enforcement differentiate between people like Stephen, who were dead serious, versus others who might have just been browsing for comparatively harmless curiosity? We don't have all the answers, but it is clear that old methods of law enforcement are being challenged by these dark web online marketplaces. And we also know that at least one other person who was on Besa Mafia's kill list, not just Amy Allwine, turned up dead. On May 29th, 2018, a few months after Stephen was convicted, John received an email with messages that involved a user calling themselves Toonbib, trying to hire a mafia hitman to kill an American soldier named Brian Nereje. Toonbib gave details of an address in Indiana where Brian could be found. As John reported in Wired, the message read, quote, "He will only be in location from June 01, 2018 to June 11. Toonbib paid just over $5,000 in Bitcoin for the hit. On June 9, 2018, Brian was found with a gunshot to the head in Clarksville, Indiana. His death has been recorded as a suicide, and the investigation has been closed. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or learned something new, please rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen. And if you're feeling really generous, tell your friends about the show, post about it on social media, or support the show by pre-ordering my new book, Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, or by becoming a Patreon subscriber at patreon.com/powercorrupts. In the next episode, Golden Handcuffs, we're going to wade into a complex ethical dilemma. Should you give amnesty to dictators or to drug kingpins if the only alternative is more death and more violence?
They're paying judges, they're paying politicians, hitmen, loads of spies.
Don't miss it. This episode was written and narrated by me, Brian Kloss. The executive producer was George McDonough, who also did the sound editing. Music by Scott Holmes. Special thanks to Nora Venon, who helped research this episode. Goodbye for now.